way, Coach.
Hold on, I'm working it up. Okay, half of you vibrate that way. Two of you fall down. Nelson, you just spin around in a circle.
Coaches, welcome back to the Talking Split podcast. I am Rob Calder, again joined by Nick Mihai. Welcome, Nick.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
And the man who was just flown back into the country, racking up frequent flyer points at the moment, Darren Best. Welcome, Bestie.
Hello, everyone. And once again, The Simpsons predicts everything. I'm pretty sure I saw that play today with the Knicks versus Pacers.
I haven't got a score check.
Easy, easy. It was close. We don't want to talk about scores yet. Let's just...
okay, gotcha. Diehard Knicks fan is Nick.
I think he tortured, knew that as well.
Yeah, so tortured, I believe, is the case for it. Everyone, thanks for jumping into the podcast. Once again, you can follow along on the Talking Split socials on Instagram and X using the handle at Talking Split. You can download the podcast from Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. If you can leave a rating, review, like, share, retweet the podcast, that would be fantastic. Bestie, we've already alluded to the fact that you have not been around much of late because you've been active overseas. What's been going on?
Yeah, a fair bit, actually. So... for those listeners that would recall, Vic Select went out to Japan in February and we played in the International Cup, which we won, which was awesome. That sort of spurred a bit of a relationship with the B Youth program over there, and they asked me to go out and run a couple of day clinic for some of their athletes, selected athletes. So that was an unreal experience. I was a little unsure how it would go with, you know, having a translator with me and... you know, also not to be bullish or, I guess, naive to think that what works for Aussie kids will work for Japanese kids. They were definitely really tired. You know, they weren't used to the pace of practice that, I guess, we run here in Victoria. But by all reports, it was really happy. They've sent me another message wanting to do it again. And, you know, I just think for us to foster those relationships and, you know, we'll go back and play in that tournament next year, just continue those communication lines open with them. And there's been a few coaches that have stayed in contact with me, which is great. And I just, you know, the game is global and it's, you know, that was awesome and was able to tack on a little bit of leave with my wife over there as well and hit up the theme parks, even though I couldn't understand any of the stories as it was going because I hadn't seen many of the movies in Disneyland and all that, but... nonetheless, it was still a good experience.
What was your favourite thing to see there in Japan when you finished working, obviously?
Good question. It's probably more like what I wanted to see go into my mouth. You know, the food was just phenomenal, you know, and it is. The Wagyu steak, I just like constantly spending too much on that.
Was it well done?
No, not quite. Not quite. Well, you cook it yourself on those little things. That's a good point. It's so thin and just... Yep. Yeah, my wife is a huge seafood lover, so we did the fish markets and all that type of stuff. So yeah,
cool.
That's awesome. But anyone that's been there, just the scale of Tokyo itself is unbelievable. Like the train stations and all that, it's just this, you know, amazing metropolitan area.
Yep. So when we talk the players that you were working with in particular, mm-hmm. what would that be comparable to here?
Equivalent of SDP.
Yep.
I would say. Yep. Yeah. So that was the way it works over there, every B1 and B2 team, so that's their pro league for the men. In order to be in that league, you've got to fulfill certain requirements. And one of them is that you've got to have a B youth program. So they'll have U18 and U15. They ran almost exclusive. So they're not necessarily in conjunction with the B League teams, although they've ran out of that facility, but they'll have their own full-time head coach, sometimes multiple assistant coaches that are full-time as well, which is, you know, just amazing. And they do basketball 5 to 6 days a week. And that's the only basketball that they'll do. So there's two streams in Japan. There's the high school stream and the B youth stream. They don't cross over. So you do one or the other. The B youth is still in its infancy. It's not that old, but you can see the appeal. So slowly players are migrating over because there's the link to the pro league. And there has been of late several kids or players progress, I guess, which is a little bit like the European system, I guess.
Yep.
Was there any differences you noticed compared to our players and how we're coaching them to over there, just based on what you saw from the players? Like, are they doing something better than we are, or is there, or vice versa?
That's interesting. And once again, to be respectful, like we went over there with a team that was younger than the teams that we were playing and won very easily. So, you know, part of that is we're just bigger than them, but we're definitely more skilled than them. They still have this real, you know, like crazy shot selection thing going on.
Yeah, you haven't seen a VJBL game lately, have you? That still exists in VJBL land here.
He's definitely been out of Victoria for a while.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they have that. They play hard. They play, yeah. You know. There's this real, like, respect thing. They're really good in transition. But, yeah, just, I guess, a lot of five out. You know, we had some posts at that camp that were identified as tall people, and, you know, we had to really... It was like, no, roll, buddy. You know, yeah, don't pop every time. So the differences would be, the major difference is they spend a huge amount of time on dynamic warm-up. I mean, like 45 minutes.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
And I actually have said, you know, they probably need to spend more time on the basketball stuff. You know, yep. Whereas we do like our 5-6 minute warm-up 2.0 core advantage thing, and it's like 5-on-5 shell.
Yep.
Right. So theirs is definitely a real slow, steady progression. You know, and we noticed that even when we played over there, when we played that university team, we walked in and the boys, like the other team, was doing all this full on stuff and chanting, and you know, which is, you know, some of that's
cool
cultural. Yeah, 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 definitely. Actually, there was one of the players that said to me, "Oh, that's kind of intimidating." And I said, "Huh, you're not playing." That's exactly what I said to him. I'm like, "You're not playing tonight, mate. You're intimidated by that warm up." But yeah, they do that different. You know, they, you know, and
does that count as their practice time, or is that like pre-practice?
Well, allocated? You know, there was. And pre-practice.
Yeah, yep, right.
Pre-practice. And there was a strength and conditioning component of it. And I was trying to listen in because there was like some lecturing and stuff as well. And I had the translator next to me who was just like awesome. But even he said to me he was unaware of some of the terminology.
Yeah, gotcha.
And he was finding it difficult to translate it back to English, which I can understand. But they, you know, they do a lot more on flexibility type stuff. You know, like they had a... like handstands, and like they had kids doing
handstands.
Mate, they had kids doing cartwheels in the warm up.
Again, you haven't seen an under 12 VJBL game for a while. That happens fairly regularly with some of those double and triple bottom age kids.
That was on my curriculum at Casey.
Yeah. Is it an activation though, or is it just them?
Well, it's core. It's core. It's you know, and mate, I don't have a degree in that stuff. It was cool to see.
Yep.
Mm. But what my concern was, they did all that and then they came into practice and I'm like, all right, are you guys alive?
Yeah.
You know, so that was a difference. And that's been a difference everywhere we've gone in Asia. So it was, we got the same feedback when we were in Taiwan, got the same feedback when we were in China. And it was the same feedback when we went to Japan the first time. The university coach was watching us saying, man, you guys just get into it straight away. And once again, similar to America, Australians only have a small amount of time with their kids. You're in America, you're in Asia, they've got them 4 or 5 times a week, yep. You know, that, and you can start to have this other stuff, let's just call it that, sprinkle in.
Yep.
You know, and I remember it as a college player. Oh, we're going to do the effort drill. We're going to spend 20 minutes.
Collective groans go through the team.
Oh, just put some new skins on, right?
Yeah, they're getting away.
Yeah.
Yep.
But we're going to spend 25 minutes of practice and one guy is going all out while the rest of us are on the sideline clapping.
Yep.
We just don't have time to do that in Australia.
Yep. Culture. And it probably saves us a little bit too in a lot of ways because it saves our players from having to go through those things that, yeah, okay, you're almost looking for things to fill time, I suppose, whereas we have to be so efficient with our training sessions. Look, we don't have time for the fluff, for lack of a better term, that they just sort of sit there on the side.
100%.
But I feel like our coaches have moved to a point, even if we did have the time, we'd use it to something far more useful than a one-man sprint, full court up and back.
And look, we've all been there where we've seen something online where I thought, oh, this is going to be great for my team, and then you roll it out in practicality and it's like, no, this is terrible. Like one person's doing something as 9 others are standing around doing nothing.
That's, yeah.
I've finally got 10 kids at practice. I want to use all 10 kids at practice.
So, you know.
Just different.
Those B youth teams, they practice 5 days a week. Sometimes 6 if they don't have games,
yep.
You know. So they are afforded more time with their kids, so they do some of that stuff, I guess.
It's interesting, six sessions a week. For some players in Victoria, that's still less than the amount of times they train. It's just there's multiple leagues, there's multiple competitions and things like that. So
yeah, but they structure it like this session's, you know, similar. I think many years ago there was a U14 Euro team come out and play, and they only did one team session a week, like as in offensive concepts.
Yep.
And that's sort of similar how they structured theirs. It was, you know, this session is individual defense and this session is shooting and this session is whatever, but it's all tailored towards one kid, whereas particularly in Victoria, like we can typically run some stuff because every coach they go to is putting in their offense, you know.
Yep.
And they create the open shot, but then they miss it because there's no skill development going on.
Yep. And that is the challenge between the two. In all honesty, of how do you weave that into what you need to have? It's all well and good to understand your structure, but if you can't pass, dribble, shoot, as an example, well, what's the point? And similar, if you can't keep the ball in front of you on the defensive end, well, it doesn't really matter. All the other stuff, like you can be the greatest zone team in the world, if you can't close out, you still can't close out.
Oh, and look, that's a great segue into the, you know, into the next thing I did with AUSA, but just, and I was on it Monday at practice with SPP, is just the velocity, I guess, and the strength of our passing is really low. And I was watching, so, you know, we went over there, there was nine teams that went, the lower teams really struggled with turnovers, and it wasn't necessarily getting the ball stolen off them, it was just passes, like they're just better athletes, shoot the gap, you know, gone, dunk.
So was that a ball handling thing, do you think, or is that a passing? Pass? Like, as in they got corralled into bad positions to be able to make the pass because their handle wasn't necessarily as good? Or is that an ability to pass under pressure?
That definitely happened, but I would just say like soft passes.
Yep.
Just really loopy, slow, steel.
Yep.
You know, like all the time.
Yep.
In transition, loopy, steel, dunk.
Yep.
Like over and over again. Now, that didn't happen in our team, you know, but the lower teams, it was a real issue. And you could just see the difference. Like the American teams, like really whipping the ball around and leading and jumping to the ball to catch it and all that because they're used to playing against that. But I would watch some of the other teams and that it's almost like they would be shocked that the defense has relentless pursuit of the ball. You know, I'm holding the ball and Nick's guarding me and it's like, oh, I'm shocked that Nick tries to swipe at it.
Yep. And that's a valid point you make there because a lot of our kids here do live in a fairly safe world where they're not – because they may have a lack of foot speed, they'll close out shorter in the hope that that will keep them in front of the ball in particular rather than closing out to actually influence the ball. And that's something they've got to get over because you're going to get blown past and it's going to happen, but you're not going to get any better by continuing to close it short.
Well, just the level of athlete there is obviously much better.
Yep.
And even like you secure a defensive rebound, ripped out of your hands, layup for the other, you know, just, oh. You know, that's why I say the relentless pursuit of the basketball defensively over there really stood out for the lower teams. They were just, you know, and they would lose games because it's like, oh, we've just had six turnovers in a row.
Yep. With the passing, I really think it's a simple case when we are developing these players at a young age. We do a lot on zero with the passing, but we don't have that layer of the defender, even if it's an advantage. And I think that's where we can... That's where the teaching point is to snap the ball, get it hard and flat, and just basic things like you spoke about the kick ahead pass, especially in your program. We should be teaching that. Like that should be broken down at our association level as well and our domestic level. And I think it builds up because these players, like even though they're second and third teams, they're very, very good players and they can get away with a softer pass.
Well, and it's funny too. Like, I think back to when I was a junior player, obviously, like under 10s, under 12s. Part of our training session was stand on the baseline and throw it as far as you can throw it, as hard as you can possibly throw it, just to find out who could more than anything else. And it's like, how many times do we see a kid take the ball out of court on the baseline and try and hit someone on the break like that? I mean, we don't see it all that often anymore because there's almost a fear of trying to throw that pass. Like, I was watching an under 12 academy team from Valencia train a couple of weeks back. And just happened to be sent the link for it and was watching their kids. They would finish like with a layup or something like that. If you were defense and you're going into offense, you would have to grab the ball, get a foot out of court and throw an underhanded scoop over half court to try and hit someone in stride to get it going. It's like, well, we would never consider throwing that here. Like, it was a lot of that.
Yeah.
But it's like, if one of our kids tried to throw that here, like, they'd be ridiculed from everyone. It's like, that's not a quick sub.
That's the problem, right?
It probably would be, but you kind of got to live with a little bit of discomfort with that too, to just try and promote the mindset of get the ball out of the net and get going again quickly.
Mate, I'm just talking like the seam to seam pass.
Yeah.
Stolen.
So is that
seam to wing pass?
Is
solid.
That angles though? Is that
just soft, just slow and soft, just not even no pop?
Well, this,
like if you're catching that ball, there's no sting in your hands.
Yep,
none.
And that is something that a lot of our kids do live in that world of self preservation, where it's like I feel like I'm getting climbed into here defensively. I just want it out of my hands as quickly as possible. So of course, there's no sting. There's no, you know, real motivation to get rid of it other than I just don't want to be the one with the turnover. It's like, wait till you're still getting the turnover because it's a bad pass getting there in the first place. It's gone.
It's also second-guessing yourself, right? Like they're in defense, they're under pressure. They're not sure whether they should throw that pass, even though they're probably instructed if this happens, go there. They're still kind of hesitant to throw it, and maybe that's why it's a bit softer as well.
Yeah, more keeping up, like for young coaches, just more keepings off games.
Yep. Mm.
And don't allow passes to go over the head.
Yeah, I'm with you. Yep.
You know, like they've got to be below head height passes and you've got to lead and you've got to get open and all that. But that's anyway.
That's a good segue because the next 2 weeks of drills on the Talking Split socials are both passing drills.
Yeah, great.
So have a look at those two if you need any more notes on them.
Well, it's demoralising when it's like turnover dunk, bring the ball down, turnover dunk.
Yeah, it's tough to come back from. Doesn't matter what your D-trans looks like.
Yeah.
Or turnover power layup. Well,
over there is what I was talking about. Yeah. Right? So
that's the thing. You're better off just turfing it up there and hoping for a rebounding contest that you can be in rather than just turnovers that lead to direct scores.
Yeah.
Like, that's the killer. Was there anything else that sort of jumped out at you?
So for us, so we went over there. We had it was nine teams. I coached the top team. We had the first few days, we had a training camp at Christian Brothers, which is where Archer McMenamin goes. Yep. So they hosted all the teams. And we had, you know, the top two teams would practice together. And then, you know, third and fourth, fifth and sixth, seventh, eighth and ninth, I think, all went together. The teams only have eight or nine on purpose because, you know, guys got to get played. They're only 16-minute halves. What I didn't realize is the rules with AAU, if you get up more than 20, it becomes running clock. And if you're up more than 20 with 2 minutes to go, they just call the game off.
Oh, wow.
So we had that a little bit. We had that four times where we were up that much. And I'm like,
I kind of like that.
Really?
Yeah, I don't mind. Yeah.
Well, think about
2 minutes ago, up 20.
You can stay here and get beaten, or you can beat the traffic.
Yeah. How many dinners I would have made.
Well, think about it the other way. When you're trying to get kids recruited and you're like, oh, I'm about to get this kid in.
Yeah.
So he gets another 2 minutes, beep, game's over.
Yeah, that's rough.
And I'm like, oh, sorry, mate.
Yeah. That was your time. That was cancelled.
Yeah.
So it does make you be a little bit more strategic.
Well, I actually, I need to shave some points here so we can...
Not that we're endorsing that. You can do the National Integrity Framework training on E-Train U at Basketball Australia.
So we did that training camp. And we did 3 days at Christian Brothers. And then we went one day to Harding, which are all great Division Twos. And then we went back to Christian Brothers. And then we played the first event in Memphis. And both of those schools offered players scholarships by just observing practice. So that works for one, that just doing it there. And then, so we went and played in Memphis. That was on the Puma Next Pro circuit. So it was a Puma shoe circuit. Everybody has to wear Puma stuff. We actually had one kid get warned for a technical foul because he had Under Armour skins on. So, you know, they take it very seriously.
Yeah, far out.
Yep, super serious. We played really well there. You know, we mercied four of the teams. So that means, you know, the scoreboard stuff. We just totally out executed everyone. Like, it was a lot of isolation hero ball. We were just like split cutting them to death and back cutting them to death. You know, just clinical is sort of how we did it. The team bought in. Like, we had a constant message. We'd talk before every game around what makes Australians good, and we sort of had three things, which was unselfishness, shape, and sharing the ball. And then I would reiterate, well, and why do college coaches want to recruit Aussies?
Yep.
And it was pretty much those same three things again, and credit to them, they stuck to it. And then when we got to the live period, you know, we knocked off the number one ranked AAU team on the Puma circuit, and that was, you know, huge deal.
What was the number one ranked team running? What style of play did they have? Was it close to ours or very different?
They actually had way better athletes than us overall. Like they had a few four-star prospects that were ranked, you know, nationally.
And what's a four-star prospect?
So number five is the highest ranked prospect you can get. So that would be like a Cooper Flagg, for example, would be a five. And once again, all of this is what the boys were telling me. I don't know. I don't read any of that junk. So that's just what they were telling me, right? Yeah. You know, they were probably one of the more organized. Like they ran a bit of a diamond stuff. They ran a stack ball screen. They had some flare screen stuff. But we knew we were going to be playing them in the live period. And I knew that they were playing in Memphis. So we filmed them and we actually had a scout. Yeah, and
you're trying to hack the AAU.
Yeah, so, yeah. And we had prepared for them in the practices leading
starting
up.
Starting to see why the USA chants were coming out.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, they definitely that was wild to hear the whole gym yelling out USA, USA. But they were probably more organized. But at the end of the day, each team has its guy or two guys, and the ball is through them a lot. In our last game, and you know our boys were cooked by the end of that tour, and in our last game we got down, I think we were down 13 with 10 minutes to go in the second half. They just had a really good little zippy guard, which we had struggled with all week. Like we had good guards but not elite speed guards.
Yep.
And he was just cooking us. I reckon he probably had about 35 points or something. And I, you know, I thought, you know, well, this is just going to be our second loss. Like it's been a long trip, multiple games in a day, you know, eating out every meal.
Previous honeymoon.
Yeah, all of that, right? You know, I didn't do a scout that game, you know. Anyway, and it was all good. It was all good until the coach started yelling, "Let him cook, they can't guard him, you know, he's killing him." And so we went the box.
Suddenly motivation.
Well, we called a timeout. We went the box and won by 13. So just put my boy Key Bongzo on him. And went in the box and won, and to see that coach just losing his mind on the sideline. So literally 10 minutes to go, down 13, end up winning by 12.
And Bestie's not been invited back to the tournament next year.
Yeah, that'd be it.
The opposite, yeah. But, you know, really good. I will say this, the AUSA group, they do a good job of getting, first of all, on that shoot circuit. Yep. You know, so you got to, you know, they get kids seen, they get them recruited. You know, every one of the kids on my team has multiple offers. Some of the kids, their signing announcements has already started. Kids on the second team have got offers, and even the third and fourth team, some of those kids have got college opportunities. They might just need to pay a little bit. So that's, you know, and then there's prep schools and all that stuff that's still to be worked out over the next couple of weeks, but they do a great job. You know, I know they've got another tour in July. They're always looking for coaches. It's just, yeah, good experience. It was something that I'd never done before. I'd coached in America plenty in high school, like high school games, but never on AAU. And just to see the zoo that it is, you know, like parents and, you know, kids are really clamoring for a scholarship, but then also just the number of coaches that were there was real. You know, some games we had, there was well over 100 coaches watching because they'd have them all. They've got an area where they're allowed to sit. You know, like no one else can go near them.
So they can all talk in peace and keep, you know,
and private
the chaos away from it going on. Because I can imagine what it's like. You know, you've got so many schools all looking for the same two or three kids. And it's like, well, okay, if you can't get those same two or three kids because only a certain amount of schools can, everyone else is fighting for everyone.
Yeah, and it's all levels.
Yeah.
So there's all levels, you know. It went, you know, all the way from, you know, big Division Ones that we saw there, all the way down to Division II junior colleges.
Yep.
There was prep schools there. There was, you know, so, and they would spread out appropriately. You know, like I would go and watch some of the AUSA lower teams and you'd turn and they'd have their coaches on their baseline watching them because there's no point in them coming to watch our game because they're not going to get those kids. So they do get seen. Obviously the top team, you know, there's more coaches watching, but that's just life. But There are some kids there that no doubt will get opportunities that they wouldn't have had. So I'm a well and truly a believer in what they do now.
Yep.
There's no one else like them in Australia.
Well, and I think it's one of those things when we talk about pathways for kids and those sorts of things. With more and more pro teams getting a little bit older, I would suggest, with who they're looking for. Like, is an 18-year-old kid going to turn your franchise around? In most cases, no. So will they go the 18-year-old or will they go the 26-year-old that's proven in a league, they know what they're getting, they're reliable, dependable? They're probably going to go the 26-year-old. Mm. So that vacuum is created almost by you maybe not getting into a pro league until you're 21, 22, in which case, what are you going to do in that period?
Mm.
You've got to do something like to get better at basketball so you can be prepared. And college is a good pathway for some of those kids. It's not for everyone, being completely transparent, but the ones that want to go down that path, it is a very good option for them to come back from college and be able to contribute at a higher level.
And pro teams are probably all for it as well, right? Like, yeah. Come and train with us in the off season, or lift with us, and then go back overseas and play some games.
Yep,
wouldn't get that opportunity.
Well, I think for kids that want to go down the college pathway, and again, not for everyone, and that's quite okay. But those that do want to go, I think it's so valuable to be seen in that environment by the coaches in front of their faces, because mixtapes will tell you part of the story, but they literally just tell you part of the story. Like, I'm confident, if you put me on court for half an hour, you'll be able to find some film that will make me look like a capable basketballer, and I'm very much not. So the mixtape side of things, yeah, okay, it'll look nice. It might get you a couple of extra hits on Instagram and those sorts of things, but our coach is going to put what is their livelihood on the line for you if they haven't seen you play in person. You know, it's going to be hard for them.
Look, that AUSA, once again, were very specific around kids creating their recruiting profiles, and yep. Twitter's the way it goes now. Yep. Like, well, X, a lot of coaches recruit off that. You know, I had to create one to go over there, right?
Yeah, but I don't have an account either. Maybe I
should. Right, yeah, seriously.
Are we getting a mixtape of you coaching or something?
No.
Okay. I'd check.
Just a few texts.
You going to send me messages on X?
I might.
Yeah, nice.
Might, yeah.
I got your school trainer one.
Yeah, there you go. That was on Instagram.
Yeah.
What about socials? Yeah, it's socials.
Check me out.
I'm checking out now.
Did you get the letter I sent you in the mail?
No. Did you send me a letter?
Yeah. That's how I normally communicate. Anyway.
Oh, I was going to say. I've just got a bunch of parking fines in my...
not the same thing.
Yeah. But, you know, they were very specific with basically saying... that you need to have your profile ready. You need to have your highlight tape on it, but then you need to message all the coaches that follow you saying, we are playing at this event. Here is our schedule. So they set that up quite well. So coaches would be like, oh yeah, this kid's playing here at this time. Here's my schedule at Wichita, or here's my schedule at Memphis. And it's on X. So, but yeah, you can't substitute playing against the guys that they're already been recruiting and evaluating. Yep. You just can't.
Wait, hang on. What did you ask anyone why they use X over every other form of communication? No. Like, is there a reason?
No.
No, you didn't. That would be one of my first questions. Just curious.
Yeah.
Well, it's probably not them looking at it, I would suggest. They'll have people that put all the schedules together.
Yeah, okay.
And that sort of stuff, so... Yeah, I don't know. It's just one more medium that I'd be stressed out by having notifications on my phone on. Like, it annoys me when I've got a little red dot saying I've got something.
Well, honestly, what happened after we knocked that number one team off, like, coaches started messaging me on there.
Yep.
Oh, wow.
Good job. You know, who do you like? You know, we need this. Could this guy do this?
Yep.
So it's real, man.
Yeah. That's a bit of a jungle.
Yeah.
Well, good to have you back in the country, Bestie. Mm. It's been a while, as we spoke about.
But we did passing drills on Monday.
Yeah, funnily enough. against the wall, or was there something more to it?
We kind of did like this like dodgeballs kind of thing, like, you know.
But with medicine balls.
Smash them in the head. No. No, we really just had an emphasis on it. We didn't do passing drills, but.
It makes sense. And look, to be completely fair, it's something that Zoe's been on about the last couple of weeks at her sessions as well, has been just backcourt passing in particular, has been the ability to enter the ball into a guard, but also the guard to get rid of it quickly without committing to a dribble or committing to a sideline, has been a big part of it. And I mean, if it's being emphasised by both your programs, I would suggest it's going to be an issue down the line as well, and up the line for that matter.
It's all things, and a lot of it's conditioning.
Yep. Just fatigue doesn't enable you to make great decisions.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
kids are not strong. Kids don't have a motor. We do a lot of stuff at low intensity.
Yep.
Well, Coot spoke about it, right? With the push up.
Yep.
Some kids can't do a push up, but that's like replicating a two handed chest pass.
Mate, we've had a kid in our program that had paid a reputable strength and conditioning coach for many years to do three sessions a week that when we tested him could not do more than 8 push-ups.
I always say to kids, if you're paying an S&C coach and you look like me, it is not money well spent.
That's the truth. I was like gobsmacked. It's like, well, yeah. Size, speed, strength, athleticism was the biggest. You know, our kids executed stuff unbelievably well. And we would just annihilate them with stuff. But then it would just get like tossed into the second row. Do you know what I mean? Like,
it's and there is a point where skill set will get you so far, for sure, but before athleticism takes over.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you are better skilled, sure, you'll be available for longer in that world. But there are some key, and we don't joke about it necessarily, but it is a bit of a thing that the taller you are, the less skilled you probably have to be in the sport, because you'll get further just on, hey, we need size. And that tends to be a thing. The hard part for us is to make sure we're not losing super talented kids that can still contribute to basketball because of the size factor. And that does come into it, whether we are aware of it or not. Like, we have to be cognizant of that, I think, as coaches.
Pretty much every coach, I'd say, oh, what are you looking for?
Size.
They would say, need a big. Everyone would say, I need a big. Yep. And then it would be either a true point guard.
Yep. When they say true, are they like facilitating
yep.
and organized? Yep.
Yep. And then it was next best available.
Yeah, right.
And I got a message from a coach this morning just about that. I got two spots left. I said, all right, what do you need? He said a big and the next best available.
Yep.
Quite often when I went through trial process over the years with junior teams, they would say the same thing. We need a big. We've got no size. And then you would walk around the door and you would see 6 of them that they've pushed down the court, down the other end. I go, they're all over there. It's like, oh, yeah, but he's not ready. He can't finish on this hand.
That's your job.
Yeah. Which Ash actually told me a story about that, where he's like, he had a session where he was running it and he goes, that's your job to teach them to be good.
Yep.
You know, like.
It is. It's the difficult challenge. And it is one of those things where I don't think people realize the value of a point guard until you don't have one.
Definitely.
Like, it is one of those areas that you can be a little bit lost in. Oh, you know, they're small and they dribble it really well. Like, yeah, they're pretty valuable. Like, they're, you know, you can still find a place for those kids in particular. So it's interesting to see.
You got to defend, though. So,
well,
you know,
that is a part of it.
We had a really good offensive point guard in our group, but they just murdered him defensively.
Yep.
They just went at him the whole game, every game.
And that's tough. Now, all of a sudden, where do you find minutes for them in that sort of situation, especially if games are finishing early, where you think you might be able to get minutes, you can't get minutes for them?
We had to run everything through him when he was on the court, and he was really good on the offensive end.
Yep.
So, and, you know, he's got offers as well, so he'll get better.
Yep.
Like, it was the first time playing against that sort of size, speed, length, everything, and just, like, foot angles and stuff like that, just... They just attack the high foot so well over there.
Yep. That makes sense. All right.
You know you make me want to have my cold chance. Have my cold chance. Have my cold chance. Come on now.
Appreciate you both playing along. I just lose a little bit of charm when Zoe's not here rolling her eyes at us on the music. But the coach shout out this week is Nathan Manley from Hamilton Basketball Association. So recently appointed director of coaching at Hamilton, has made significant strides in gathering resources and expanding his knowledge to support local athletes and coaches. Credit to him and the Hamilton coaching staff for actively engaging wider networks from a rural area and contributing to the development of multiple state calibre kids. So there have been a number of kids make state teams coming out of Hamilton recently, and it is one of those things that actually gets noticed a fair bit. It's like, okay, what's going on here? Like, why is this happening? Is there someone involved in those types of things? So congratulations to Nathan on that one for getting recognised. And it is one of those areas that if you do have a coach shared out that you want to throw through, by all means, do that. What we are talking about today, though, is end-of-game scenarios in particular. And this is an area that, as coaches, we don't always get the opportunity to be in, but it is one of those things that it's hard to get reps at unless you practice it at your training sessions. You don't want the first time where you have to try and diagram something on a whiteboard to be when you're 1 point down, trying to hold on to a lead or anything like that. You want, you know, some reps at this from both a playing and a coaching perspective. So when we talk end-of-game coaching, it is a fairly stressful area more than anything else. This is also the fun stuff that we don't get to do all that often. So when we look at end of game stuff, Bestie, what are some of the things that front of mind for you as an end of game, if you're on the offensive end, what are some of the things you were starting to think of straight away?
I was thinking about this yesterday when you gave me the topic. the first thing is you need to have a very clear, defined way that you are labeling your players if you are using a whiteboard.
As in, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 or initials?
Initials, yep, whatever it is. Is it like, what if you've got two with the same initials?
Yep.
Like, how are you doing that? You know, have you practiced that? You know, do the players know who they are? You know, and if you use 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, do the players need to know who's what position? Yep. So before you even get into all of that, the other one is making it clear to them where the ball actually is. And like, I tend to flip my board around. So it's actually, yep, if it's down one end, I'll turn it around so it's that way, so they can, yep, see that's exactly how it is. So those things I think are important. And then it's knowing skill sets of your individual players. You know, if you need three, who's it going to be? If it's, if you know, who are you coaching against on the other end? Because, you know, are they going to recognize that you're going to get that certain person a shot? So maybe they're the decoy, or there's a rescreen for them or something like that. And then more importantly, what is the situation?
Yep.
You know, so if you're in a situation where you're up and they're playing the foul game, you know, where do you want the catch to be? Who do you want to catch it? Who's the first option? Who's the second option? What do you do if they switch? What do you do if they zone? Like,
yep,
that type of stuff, yeah.
Yep. What about you, Nick? What are the things you're taking into consideration?
Very similar to what you were saying. Definitely practice what is written on the whiteboard prior to that, so they know exactly how I draw things. It's usually a set 5 or 6 players that I've worked out throughout the season. I'm thinking about not only when we score, but also what's going to happen after that. So if there's a little bit of time, what are we getting into after that as well? So I'm thinking about two-part things.
You may not have time to call a second time out, or the other team may not call it, so you've got to almost script.
Yeah, and almost down the road, predict a little bit.
Yep.
And it's also a good psychological thing when you talk to players. I often use the old, hey, when we score, we're in this, rather than if we score, just, yep, to put into their mind, we are going to score this next basket. And then I'm trying to figure out basically what the opposition coach, how they've been defending me all game. Because if they make any small changes, they're still habitual creatures and they're going to go to what they know. And can I throw a bit of deception in there to try and get what I actually want open as well?
Yeah, I like it. So, I mean, a couple of things you're going to have to talk about. If you're in a fortunate position where you have an assistant coach, obviously you would hope that the assistant coach will walk up to you and say, ball's coming in from here with this amount of time remaining, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a few things that you'd want to go. The biggest things, for one, time remaining. Like, you need to know how long is left, because the amount of times I've seen a coach draw something up on a whiteboard that takes too long to unfold, like there might be 4 seconds left, but the play doesn't really get good until the 6 second mark, too late. So time remaining has to be something really conscious. And I know I've gone down the path in years gone by where I have a certain play for 6 seconds or less and a different play for 6 seconds or more in that sort of world. So conscious of time remaining. Score difference, up or down, like that's one of those things. Does the score do you play in a league where score difference might matter? So, hey, we're down by 2, but we need to get up by 3 to get head-to-head on this team if we run into the same sort of level in finals. So being conscious of what that looks like.
That happened to you, Darren, a couple of years ago? There was, yeah, something like that, right?
Yeah, and we knew the scenario going in, and that's, yep, why we continued to play the way we played. Yeah.
Yep, but it is something that a lot of people will only focus on the game and not the bigger picture in that world. Possession, and more to the point, possession arrow. Like, so you need to know what that arrow looks like, that if something gets caught in the wrong spot and that's a jump ball, do you get it back? In which case you might get another opportunity to run whatever you're running in that sort of space. Foul situation, that is one of the biggest things that I think coaches are missing at the moment, is understanding, are they likely to foul you in this world? Because I'm absolutely a coach that will foul deliberately if that gives me an opportunity back in the game. And also, how many timeouts have you got left? Mm-hmm. Like, if you need another one, can you get another one? Because, you know, we joked about this, I think, after the podcast last week, Nick, that one of the biggest jobs our assistant coaches have had over the years is telling me what quarter it is, in the game, because the amount of times it was like, is it the third quarter or the fourth quarter? No, it's for the fourth. And so, good. If I'm not retaining that, I'm probably not retaining how many timeouts do I have left, because that's a blur as well. And in particular, when you have that timeout that you lose with 3 minutes to go, if you haven't used one of them, you will lose a timeout in that space as well. So again, being really conscious of that, because there have been times I thought I had a timeout, and because I hadn't blown one prior to that, I didn't. And where I thought I had three, I had two, and I wasn't across it.
And sometimes parents are under pressure. They don't want to do the scoreboard either, so they sometimes might make a mistake. So
the worst job in the world. I can categorically tell you, if I was ever scoring a game, it will be wrong. Like, do not trust me in that sort of space. So a couple of things from this. What sort of actions do you feel like? And because I think the vast majority of us, if we have a timeout, end of game, the ball's probably going to be at a sideline. It doesn't. Yes, you will occasionally have a baseline, but more often than not, it's going to be off a sideline. So bearing that in mind, what type of actions do you feel like will give you the best quality shot in that world, bestie?
Up or down? So down?
Yeah, let's go down.
Okay. I definitely like more off-ball screens than on-ball screens. So let's just go that way to begin with. I just think everyone's – like, if you're down and the clock's low, it's a good strategy to double it. You know, I think definitely if it's less than 4 seconds, because you typically jam the first pass out of it and then it's done. But I think the off-ball screening stuff is where teams can get confused with switching and that type of stuff. So I'd be working some of that flare screen or split screen stuff to try and create some confusion with my two best players.
Yep, I really like. What about you, Nick?
It's funny just going back to the habitual creatures, right? Like we have our likes and dislikes. I like to go through the doors, which is just a screener sits on either side of the free throw line, shooter runs through the middle. Usually it's your... Hopefully it's your best player and best shooter. If they catch a ball and they can't get a shot out of it, I like to finish with an on ball and play out of that. Like if I don't get a shot immediately, and it's dependent on the score as well and where I am on the scoreboard, but if I can't get a quick three, then I'm looking for an on ball screen and some different actions after that as well. Yeah.
Yeah, and it is difficult because obviously, I mean, a lot of the answers to a lot of these will be depends, because it depends on your personnel, their personnel, all those types of things too. So it's just, this is more things just to consider. For mine, I hate catching the ball in a corner, and I will really worry in particular when we call the timeout in advance of the ball. There are two really bad spots to catch it, being in the corner from where you're inbounding it or towards half court in the corner, because for mine, that is just like prime, we're going to get you into the back court, steal, deflection, layup. They worry me a lot. So I
coffin corner? Is that what they use?
Coffin corners, yeah. So I try and keep them out of those as best I can. I'm much like you, bestie. I prefer off-ball action personally, and... For mine, any action that enables you to get a slip out of it is usually the one that is guarded the least. And it's amazing how often that happens, that you have all this action that plays out in front of you and everyone's really worried about where the shooter is, and all of a sudden the screen has gone to the basket and they get 2 points out of it and the game's still very much alive. So you will have to make the call, I suppose, if you're down two or three, are you going to tie? Are you going to try and win? You know, what are you really looking for? Like, what sort of shot do you want out of that? And then, to be honest, we all want the same thing, high-quality shot from one of our better players that can make that shot in particular. But you've also got to be careful as to how much you diagram, I suppose, in that, hey, we're looking for this shot here. It's like, well, okay, what if that's taken away? Like, do you go to a second option? And if we can't get that, we get this. How far down the line do you go on that? Because then it just becomes like a mess of everyone thinking, yeah, well, hopefully we don't get those first three shots because then I get the shot that's coming next. That can be something you've got to be really careful of. And I think shot selection in particular is a really key one. Late clock, you're probably just happy to get anything away that you can get away.
Yeah, I think the role clarity thing, you know, we didn't have any situations with the Navy team this year where we were down and needed to execute, but we had the opposite where we were up and the other team was playing the foul game. And we sort of inverted the zipper, so the catch was on the block. You know, not towards halfway, because that like scares me too, like tip away. And then we had a flare screen at the top and then a lead back to the ball on the elbow. And we executed that really well and knocked the foul shots down. But everybody was aware of who we wanted to catch the ball, and no one had any problems with it. Like, and I think that needs to be established.
Well, and early. Going back to your passing point from earlier, who the inbounder
is.
Like, that matters so much, because we see so many times the opposition team will go and just put their tallest player on the sideline and say, well, you go and just disrupt angles. Your good passers will still find an angle. That's the important part. Sometimes they take three or four steps down the sideline that, you know, they can get away with, depending on who's watching what, but it matters.
Well, does everybody remember that pass to Aussie rap in the under 20s two years ago?
Yeah.
You know, like that was, you know, and I've put two players on the inbound before at a national championship and created a turnover.
I've done that many times as well.
It is amazing how often it happens. I first saw Andre Lamanis do it when he was coaching Brisbane, where he sent two of the ball and it's like this, it's different. It's, but I actually don't mind it. Like it's take away all possible angles. I was listening to Jerry Wright did a performance course for Basketball Australia that was in Victoria a couple of years ago, and his thing was anything off a sideline, you want a mismatch, an isolation, and a misdirection. Like in any offense that you run out, you want those three things. So mismatch, isolation, misdirection. It's like the more I think about that, it's like, yeah, okay, well, that makes a lot of sense. Like, do I want my best player with the ball? Potentially, but are they also my best passer? Maybe. So how do I get them to come back? Like, is there someone I trust that can get the ball in that sort of situation? Similar to what you were talking about before, Bestie, with inverting that zipper. Okay, same action that we've seen, but we just flip it the other way to make sure that the right person gets the catch in the right spot. From an offensive end, there are so many things to actually consider. For mine, I think I tend to find myself on the defensive end more than the offensive end in late game situations, where I've almost got to try and find a way to get back into the game. I don't know if that says more about my coaching than anything else, but it just tends to happen more that I don't often get the opportunity to execute a play and draw something up to diagram it. It's more trying to get back into a contest. Like, Nick, is there anything you do defensively, I suppose, late games?
Yeah, definitely try to be deceptive on the defensive end as well. The second player to the ball has worked for me in the past, and it has gone horribly wrong as well. Like, most recently, my last season, I tried that double down, and the poor kid, I just put him in the worst spot because they zone. Basically, you send a second person to defend the inbounds, and then you zone off with the other three and try and pinch it because you're down by so much and you don't have the shot clock anymore. So he missed the steal, and one of the players just absolutely jammed it on top of him, and it made the socials as well.
He still
blames me for making him do that because I sent the big to get more length. Anyway, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Another thing that I've tried is I've got the tallest defender to stand in front of the inbounds player, and he's jumped as high as he can twice in the air, okay? And as soon as he's jumped twice, he turns around and he starts denying anyone who's leading to the ball, because generally what's happening is there's some sort of action and then someone's flashing up to the ball, primarily probably their best player is trying to get the ball. So I'm trying to take that away, and then hopefully the next best person is picking up the ball instead of the primary guy, and we can take that away. I've also tried to invert that as well and take away, depending on what the coach does, and try and take away catches early if there's some sort of flash towards the ball, and then he turns around and puts pressure on it to try and get a shot clock out of bounds violation.
Yeah, we would just, the boys started doing it naturally this year with the Navy team, where they would just switch it from the inbounder. So the inbounder would catch the
whoever,
and then, you know, the guy would catch the inbounder. Yep. So, and that can create some disruption and helps with your denial stuff.
Yeah, it does. And I really like that, to be honest. In particular, I mean, you sort of alluded to it, Nick, there will be a countdown on the sideline, like five, like one, two, three, and everyone will be counting that thing, like coaches, players, parents, they will be letting the ref know, hey, we're getting close to 5 seconds here. I think by almost watching it play out, and it's like, well, now we're going to try and deny it and make it the inbounder second guess themselves a little bit as to, is this a good option or not? Is a good way to do it. I think like pre-switching is a good way to go about it as well. Can be a really good way of saying, well, okay, we're going to put the guard on the big in the post, and all of a sudden the play that is diagrammed almost goes out the window because the inbounder sees, actually, that's a guard on big down there. Like, this is a good option for us. They go away from what has been diagrammed, and you can start to manipulate it a little bit that way. And you don't get involved in screening action then if you can do that. Or it's an easier switch out when it comes from that point too.
It's important to know if you're up or down on the O end or the D end, like what is your best lineup for trying to achieve what you are.
Yep.
You know, so if you're going to go an all switching group, then, you know, you need to make sure you've got that team in.
And understand what they're trying to achieve. If they're down three, probably get your big off and put some long, lengthy wings if you've got them across the board and switch everything.
Yep.
Potentially.
No, I really love that. And even teaching your players to foul properly without giving up an unsportsmanlike foul is such a valuable part of it, because, look, I know I've done it previously. It's like, okay, we're going to foul. and you walk out and found it's unsportsmanlike. It's like, well, now we're in a worse spot than we were before this time out.
Because so, they grabbed the shirt from behind. They stupid.
Like, you know, love them to death, but sometimes their players take us a little bit literally. That can be a problem. So even teaching how to foul properly to make sure that it doesn't get escalated in that sort of space. Because, and you know, rightly or wrongly, there are times where the officials know you're about to foul, but don't call it because it's not enough contact. It's like, no, it's got to be enough contact. So where you can try and get body fouls, reaching in with the inside arm across, they tend to be the ones that are fouls, but not catastrophic fouls that everyone would sit there and say, hey, that's a big issue here. I always like to trap the first catch if you can, like using the inbounder to go and get that one straight away. In particular, when teams would expect you to foul, and go and trap first without fouling straight away and just seeing if you can get the player to be a little bit loose with the ball, you're talking about, Bestie, that's expecting the foul will be coming here. All of a sudden it's not, and again, 5-second count can start to impact on that. So I think there are different ways that you can do that. Defensively, up three. We'll say last possession of the game. So clock's turned off, 14 seconds, whatever it is. Would you foul it? So teams in bonus, up by 3 points, would you foul it?
Well, you know the answer is going to be depends.
Well, of course.
Right, and so we're just asking for just a blatant yes or no is what you want, just regardless. No.
You wouldn't? Let it play out and trust the defense?
Yeah.
Yep. Any particular reason why you go down that path?
Well, just my teams of late have been really good defensively.
Yep. So happy to just...
And we prioritise that, yeah.
Yep. Fair enough. Nick, any different?
Yes, I would foul.
Yep.
Because statistically, I get the possession back. I'm in control of the game.
What's your rebounding like, though?
Excellent. He's got Shaq twice.
100%.
That is something you've got to take into consideration.
Though. 100%.
It is.
Puts pressure on them, though. They have to, you know, potentially hit the first free throw as well.
Like, who is it?
Who is who?
Do you talk about that?
Who we foul?
Who's got it?
Well, that's the hard part, trying to keep it out of the wrong person's hands. Yeah. Like, if you can get a bad free throw.
Yeah, what team were you referencing? They're not going to...
Well, that's the hard part, though. And this is where you can get caught both ways on it. Because if you go and foul the worst free throw shooter, yeah, they might miss it, but that puts them in a position to get an offensive rebound that can give them an extra possession. You go and foul the best free throw shooter, they make both. Yes, you are in control then, because you can call the timeout or you can foul or whatever you want to do. Sometimes there's no right answer.
I'm aware. I've just asked you the thing that I said we weren't going to do.
Yeah, that's okay. So
depends on what.
But the fear in his eyes at the moment is brilliant as he's trying to work his way through.
It's not, because it's like there's no foolproof answer, right, to this to this question. No. But statistically.
Oh, no, I understand that. But we're talking a Friday night, court six at whatever. Yep. That ref is going to get whoop, unsportsmanlike.
Well, it's how you word it to your players. I would tell them to aggressively play the ball because at the end of the day, it's either a possession arrow. Again, it depends.
Yep.
But like if you have the possession arrow, if you're aggressively going in and trying to grab that thing two hands, they're also fully aware, the referees, that you're probably going to try and foul or it's going to be very aggressive. So they're ready to blow their whistle anyway. Mm.
I've told them. Previously,
coming
into the timeout, it's like, hey, just letting you know, we are going to be fouling on this possession. Mm. I think when I did it, it was 15 seconds to go, and I said, our kids have been instructed at the 6-7 second mark, give one up. And we did have one to give, to be completely fair. And the ref sort of looked at me a little bit confused, and I'm like, no, we are fouling. Like, this is going to be a foul at the 6 or 7. We're not fouling a shooter. I was very clear about that, but we will foul someone. And honestly, we walked within about 3 feet of a kid that had the basketball and threw a hand at it, and the rest like, foul. I'm like, yes, good reffing. I really like this.
I think I've asked the group before.
Yep.
What should we foul?
Do you want to? Not should.
Have you always done it, though?
No.
No, okay.
Is depends that on you've got more confident? That's where I was going to go.
Saw Capes do it once, actually, in a... it's like a scrimmage or something.
Yep.
He put it on them.
Yep.
And he said, well, you know, buy in, belief.
Well, how would you teach? How would you guys teach it, right? Like, how would you teach them to foul without getting an unsportsmanlike? Because that's the other caveat in this as well.
It is a part of it.
You know?
But then this could also be used to help your passing problems with players. You have to play through some contact here, one, to make the pass, but two, we are going to foul you on the way through here. So you can almost double it, sort of, I think, a little bit too.
The one thing's for sure, whatever it is, clarity.
Yeah.
Right? If you're not fouling, you're not fouling. If you are fouling, you're fouling. We use on and off.
Yep.
Right? Because I don't like yelling out foul because then that's referees start to think, you know, yep. whatever.
Yeah, but unsportsmanlike comes into it.
Yep. We use on and off.
Yep.
You know?
Steal, it's one I've heard a lot over the years. Like, steal it and the, you know, it gives the impression that steal it is code for foul it.
Do you ever... hey, I'm going to defend the inbounds up until this time and then foul after that.
Definitely. Yep.
That becomes harder for lower-ranked teams to understand the difference because some kids... too. Yeah. Like, it's hard for a player on the court to understand that as well.
Yep.
We didn't say we've got one trap. If we don't steal it out of that, we're going to go.
Yeah, so it's clear at the start, right? Yeah, that's a good one.
Yep. One of the things you do have to be careful with as well is what the shot clock is. So, in particular, there might be... 22 seconds left in the game, ball's in the front court, you foul, it goes down to 14, all of a sudden there is an extra possession in that game, like those types of things.
Well, that's where you can then be yelling out on and off.
Yeah, and I think that's...
you know, that's why we do that.
Yep.
So then we'd say, we're off now.
So again, clarity matters. Yeah. Because there's always one kid that says, oh, geez, I didn't realise on that one, and that's your game, essentially. Yeah.
At every level. We've seen it in the NBA multiple times. The guy, teams have thought we're up. When they're down or whatever.
Yep.
J.R. Smith's
a big one.
Yeah. There was the DeAndre Jordan one too where he just got the offensive rebound and didn't shoot it and just let the clock expire. Did you see that one?
Yeah, that's 101 on how not to be well-liked by your teammates.
Yeah, Chris Paul was not happy.
Yeah, LeBron wasn't real thrilled with J.R. Smith either from memory.
I still remember that picture too of J.R. Smith. It's like, and LeBron, what do you mean we're up?
What are you doing? Like, it's over on the sideline.
I thought we were up. That's what he was.
Yeah, exactly. But... these are situations, but again, the biggest thing is practice this at practice.
Yeah, yeah.
There needs to be something. So I've been really big over the last couple of seasons I've coached to make sure that whatever we're running out of the sideline is the same shape that we would normally run out of a sideline. And same with the baseline. Mm. Like, don't reinvent something that you don't use all the time. Try and get something you already use with a wrinkle in it. So, you know... we've all sort of joked about how our players don't tend to remember a lot of stuff, in particular in high-pressure moments. So if you can get them into the creatures of habit you were talking about, Nick, get them into something that they are familiar with. So even if what you've diagrammed up doesn't work, the rest of your play can fold out as it needs to fold out. One of the things, the decisions that coaches have had to make a lot lately is, do they advance the ball or not?
Mm.
And that's actually a bloody stressful decision to have to make. I've leaned towards of late not advancing. Where I possibly can, like keep it in the back court where I think there's a little bit more space and I can then diagram something up if we need to get an offense necessarily. But I worry about, similar to what we're talking about with the coffin corners, I worry about the advancing and being locked into only one area of the court. Is there a situation, Bestie, where you would or wouldn't advance? Like, is that a rule?
Yeah, I often don't advance, but it's, what's the shot clock situation? Obviously, if it's, above 14 and you're up or whatever, you probably... stupid to do it because you're going to create another possession for the other team.
Yep. Or knowing the 8-second count. If you've fumbled around for 4 seconds, it goes out of court, you might want to advance and get it.
That's one of my biggest frustrations coaching in America. It's like, well, it's 10 seconds there,
yep.
and then the coach runs on the court, calls a timeout, and it restarts the backcourt.
But can they also in the US, they're in the front court, they can throw it in the back, right? That's
all that stuff. I will say, like, we iced a game... like, I ran onto the court with, 1 second to go in a game and called a timeout because it was looking like we're going to get a jump ball.
Yep.
And, I had said just to, out of the timeout, I'd said to the coach, you need to listen to me, to the ref, you need to listen to me for a timeout. I've, it's been a long week, I'm losing my voice.
Yep.
And, I was literally right behind him on the court. Yeah, because you can do that over there.
Yep.
Timeout, timeout, timeout. And, the other team was screaming for a jump ball, but, can't do that here. But...
please do not run under the court as a coach in Australia.
I do think, just have your clarity.
Yep.
What are you doing? Have your clarity. I think know the shot clock, know the backcourt situation. What have you just been seeing? Like, everybody saw the Final Four. Like, I saw it in person. Yes, that's a brag. But I saw it. I saw Duke just melt down against the press. You guys see that? Like, they got a technical foul. Houston got a technical foul for swiping the ball out of the inbounder's hands.
Yep.
And they still won because they just couldn't. And I know you can't advance it in college in that moment, but they could not get the ball up. You know, it was just turnover. So, like, what are you playing against? So maybe, yeah, you might need to eat some shot clock because you're like, man, we're just going to turn it over here. You just know you are.
Yep. It is a big thing. And even on the defensive end, when we're talking advancing or not, you might have to go in there with two different plans. Mm. Look, if they advance it, it's going to be this. If it stays in the backcourt, it's going to be that. And again, that takes up a lot of bandwidth for your players in a pressure moment.
I often hit my inbounder with, like, when we do advance it, you know, the importance of not throwing a turnover.
Yep.
Which I, you know, I understand the irony in that, but I'll say to them often, like, we'll eat a 5 second call.
Yep. Absolutely.
Because we'll have
at least you got a chance.
We'll have set defense.
Set D.
But with backcourt and frontcourt stuff, you have to rep it somewhere, right? Like, when you play 5-on-5, start it in the backcourt under pressure and put some clock pressure in training. Like, these kids need to be exposed to it before they run into it.
Yeah, well, and it's funny because Zoe did this on the weekend with her NPP and SPP group. So the back half of the afternoon session was, okay, we're going to do some scenario stuff down the stretch. Fernando was in town, so he had the pleasure of taking the offensive group. And what was really interesting was afterwards how many of them were able to say what he had said in the timeout. Like, and that was a real key moment. It's like, well, was his clarity good? Was what he was looking for good? Did it stick with them in that sort of space?
Because
I like that.
Straight away, like, and one of the girls asked, she's like, what's the foul situation? And like, Zoe's just like, oh, how good is this? Like, the fact that you're thinking about this along the way. Great reps for Fernando because he gets the diagrams and stuff off a whiteboard. And he made the same comment, obviously. He didn't know all the players, so he had to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 rather than initials. He would rather go initials, fair enough. But it was good reps to see who could perform under pressure as well, because clock was on. Hey, you got to figure this out. Sometimes what you diagram is not what you get, and you got to take whatever you can get in that sort of space. But afterwards, so many of the girls were able to say, actually, what he said was this, then this, then this. And we go to Fernando. I was like, is that correct? And he's like, yeah, it was. I was like, well, this is fantastic, the fact that you've actually retained this information, because a lot of times they don't.
It's a skill.
Yeah. And you've got to rep it. It's no different.
We did something similar with when I was with Dom and Flemo with Vic Metro, where he would take the inbounds and he was like, all right, Mihai, you take defense. Don't tell me what you're doing, though. Yep. And then I just had to change it how I wanted to. And it was just for him to test out his end of play scenarios and see if what he throws out there is going to work against most things, because you don't necessarily have something for everything.
Well, one of the teams on Saturday came out in a zone. It's like, well, you're probably not expecting that last possession of the game or so, but that's what they decide they want to go with. And it's like, well, good. Give the players some autonomy as to similar to what you were talking about earlier, Bestie. What do you want to do? Like, you've got to own this as much as anybody else from a playing perspective. Sometimes the coach doesn't have the timeout to call everyone over. They might be able to get one play, but then they've got to get the other four players to work out what's going on. It's hard to do.
Yeah, trust with your point guard.
Yep.
You know, I know there was, if we went a bit dry sometimes with the Navy team this year, if Ryder didn't have any, like, I would always have something ready, but if Ryder didn't come to me and say, hey, we're this, often he would have it, and I'd say, cool. Just look for this or something like that, I would say. So,
Like it. But I think the biggest thing is, you know, get used to drawing on a whiteboard. Like, as a coach, we don't often get to do it, in particular with ball on sideline, ball on baseline, having to figure out what's coming next. Get used to drawing it. Get used to knowing what your offense is. But get your players used to it as quickly as possible. And that might be how you win training. Like, just, hey, we're going to do a couple, away we go. Because, again, it's the fatigue thing that you were talking about before, Bestie. How well do our kids make decisions when they're tired?
No one does.
Like, but just going back to the whiteboard thing, I've spoken about this on the pod before. The clarity on the whiteboard is almost the most important thing.
Yep.
Like, they need to be able to.
Makes sense to you, but does it make sense to them?
Well, Peter Lonergan, I always quote him that he used to say, whiteboard it, take a photo of it, and try and read it the next day. And if you can't read it, they couldn't read it at that time. Yep. So, like, be really clear with how you whiteboard. I've seen a lot of coaches, they whiteboard and they go, look, it's really clear, but they've done the first action, and then when they've getting to, let's say, the second side, they just continue to draw the lines, which makes sense to them because they're following the lines, but these kids just see a bunch of squiggly lines instead of rubbing it out and going, all right, now you're here and now you're going to move there. So that takes practice.
Well, and one of the real tests, I think, is when your players walk out of the timeout, when you see them turn to the other player and go, what the hell's going on?
Yeah.
Like, that's always a really alarming sign, I think, as a coach. So, something I think that hopefully coaches can go and get a little bit of practice on over the next little bit as well, because, you know, we are coming to the back half of the season. Games do tend to get a little bit closer. You may need this maybe not end of game, but it might be just before halftime. You get the opportunity to get a timeout and get something as well. So you should always be thinking about this, I think, as a coach.
And you know what? If you've been passing the ball well, you might be up.
It solves all your problems so that this isn't an issue in the first place. No, look, Bestie, Nick, thanks very much for jumping back in. Coaches, we'll catch everybody next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Talking Split Podcast. Make sure you like and comment on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to share and subscribe so that you never miss an episode.